அன்பர்கள் அனைவருக்கும் எங்களுடைய காலை வணக்கங்கள். இன்று லைஃப் டிவைன் மீட்டிங் நடக்க இருக்கிறது. இந்த டாபிக் மெமரி, ஈகோ அண்ட் செல்ஃப் எக்ஸ்பீரியன்ஸ். கேரி சார் அவர்கள் பேச இருக்கிறார்கள். அன்பர்கள் அனைவரும் அமைதியோடு பங்கு கொண்டு அன்னை அருளை பெற்றுக் கொள்ளுமாறு வேண்டிக் கொள்கிறேன். அன்னைக்கும் பகவானுக்கும் முதற்கள் வணக்கங்களை கூறி இந்த நிகழ்ச்சியை துவங்குகிறோம். இப்பொழுது ஐ எம் இன்வைட்டிங் மிஸ்டர் கேரி டு ஸ்டார்ட் தி டாபிக்.
குட் மார்னிங். When Lizzie reads Jane's letter and learns of Lydia's elopement, she's totally shocked. When Darcy comes the next minute and she tells him that Wickham and Lydia have eloped, he's so shocked he refuses to believe it. In spite of the fact that he knows that Wickham is a scoundrel and Lydia is capable of any foolishness, something in him refuses to believe it. When Lizzie announces to her father and to Jane that she's engaged to Darcy, they give the response, "Impossible. Impossible." That's what Lizzie said to Charlotte when she said she was engaged to Collins. Impossible. None of them are able to understand what is happening to them or why. They're not able to make sense of their own experience. Are there any events in your own life that puzzle you, surprise you, shock you, mystify you? Chapter 9, Sri Aurobindo talked about memory, self-consciousness. What was the third term? Memory, self-consciousness. Ego is there. No. That's this chapter. Last chapter, memory, self-consciousness. Forgot the last term. It's very interesting, huh? I don't think it's not ego. Memories. Very, very interesting. There the topic was, ignorance. The topic is, he was telling us, we are ignorant of who we are. Self-consciousness means our knowledge of who we are. That's what he meant. We're ignorant of it. This chapter, memory, ego, and self-experience. And he's going to tell us, we are ignorant of our experience. We're not only ignorant of what's happening to us, but much more importantly, we're ignorant of why it's happening, of what is the significance of it, of what we are to learn from it, of what it means for our life, of why our soul has come, why it has sought this experience, what we should learn from it, and how it should help us progress. So we're still at the stage where he's reminding us that the nature, our nature as human beings, is one based in the ignorance. And unless we understand the nature of that ignorance and how we are living in it, blinded by it, limited by it every day, every minute, in everything that happens, we miss the opportunity that life is offering us to come out of it, because that is the purpose of life, and there is no other purpose. We may think the purpose of life is to get married or get a job or earn more money or have amusement or anything we want. The purpose of our life for which our soul has come is to evolve out of the ignorance and discover the delight that's there in that evolution. So if we miss that, we don't miss a part of the show, we miss the whole show. We get the cover of the book without the contents. We get the peel of the banana without the fruit. We're ignorant of our true self. That's what he told us in the last chapter. What do I know of my own self? Of my deepest, inmost aspirations and motives? What do I know of my past life or my future destiny? What does Darcy know, really know, of his strengths, of his virtues, of his weaknesses? Certainly more at the end of the story than at the beginning, that much we are clear. That's why he's a hero for us, because he learned something from his experiences. Do we always learn from our experiences? Probably not. Darcy doesn't know why he's attracted to Lizzie. In fact, he doesn't even know that he's attracted to Lizzie at the beginning when he calls her tolerable. Appa has said that his calling her tolerable out loud is his first proposal to her. He's unaware that his own behavior is boorish, offensive, mean, selfish. It's very obvious to us, but it wasn't obvious to him. He's equally unaware of the deepest inner capacities of what he's capable of, which we discover only later. What about Eliza? What makes Elizabeth so cheerful? Does she know why she's happy, happier than other people? Where does she get her energy from? What is it that really attracts her to Wickham? She thought it was love. Later she discovered it was only vanity. She was flattered that he's giving her more attention than other girls. Is she really a romantic? Or is she mercenary like Charlotte? What makes her laugh when Darcy insults her by calling her tolerable? What makes her hate Darcy, dislike him intensely? Why does her courage come out when she's attacked? Where does that courage come from? Where does she get the strength to resist Lady Catherine, who blows everybody over just like a leaf? She accuses Darcy of staring at her at the dance. She doesn't say that to him. She says it to Charlotte, I think. Why is that man staring at me? So I was thinking of it. Maybe there's 100 or 200 people in the room during that dance. And they're all either they're dancing and talking to a partner, or what do we do when you're in a dance like that? You're looking around at other people who are dancing and talking to their partners. And there's at least 100 or 200 people in the room. Does Lizzie know what all of the other 200 people are doing? Does she know where they're looking? Does she know who they're staring at? The only thing she notices is, that man is staring at me. How does she know that? Unless she's looking at him, unless she's particularly interested in what he's thinking and doing, she's staring at him. When she reads his letter at Hunsford, she says, I've been acting absurd. I never knew myself till now. Like the characters, we're ignorant of ourselves. And much more so, we're ignorant of everybody else around us. I can see you. I can see whether you're smiling or sleeping or sad or serious. But I don't know what's going on in your head. I don't know what's going on in your heart. Even when I think I know what's going on in my head, I don't really know most of it. Then how can I know in you? And what's going on the other side of that wall or upstairs or downstairs or around the corner? It's outside my self-experience and my knowledge of it. What do we really know of the people who we relate to? Our family, friends, acquaintances. What does Darcy understand about Wickham's role in his life? Why is this man constantly coming back? He tries to elope with Georgiana. He's tempting Lizzie. Then he goes after Lydia. What is this man doing in my life? Darcy must be wondering. What does he understand of it? Did he ever conceive that Wickham would try to elope with his sister? Or actually elope with Lydia? Did he ever imagine that that Wickham would become his own brother-in-law and that he would make it happen? What was he really thinking when he proposed to Lizzie at Hunsford? Did he really think she would accept? What did he understand about Lizzie? What did he know about her? After Lizzie says, "You're the last man on earth I would ever marry," what does he think about the future? What does he think about the future of his life and his life and Elizabeth's life and their possibility together? We're not only ignorant of ourselves and ignorant of other people and ignorant of what's going to happen in the future and ignorant of what's happened in the past, but most importantly, we're ignorant of the ultimate reality of our own being and the world. We're ignorant of the divine. We're ignorant of the transcendent, which has not only created everything, that has become everything. That is not only the self, but is our self. It's interesting in this story that no one in the story, including Collins, who's supposed to be a clergyman, a religious man representing God, nobody ever thinks of God. Nobody ever speaks about the divine. Even when Lydia elopes, and the family faces ruin, divine doesn't come into the picture. For many of us too, mother's a last resort. First, let me try persuasion, or let me offer a little more money, or let me apply my intelligence or my knowledge or ask my friends or rely on my family. When all else fails, the definition of as a devotee, that we don't stop there. Oh, now what about mother? Even when we think of mother, even when we call her, what do we really know about mother? Why has mother come? Why is mother relating to us? Why is mother answering my prayer? Why is mother not answering my prayer? What do we really understand about the most important thing, not only in the universe, but beyond the universe? What do we know of the supreme power that's created the universe? One disciple once asked Sri Aurobindo, "Is it true that mother could supramentalize the world in one day if she chose to?" He said, "Yes." then how much do we understand Mother? Do we know that she has that power? Is that real to us? And if it's real to us, do we understand why she didn't do it already in one day? These are not trivial questions. These are the most fundamental questions of our own existence. What do we really know of grace that's secretly guiding our lives and protecting us? Is it secretly guiding our lives? Are we aware? That's because it's a secret, I guess. That's what it means, that we're not aware of. It's a secret from us. We are not aware of how grace, we are ignorant of how grace is acting in our lives. We are only aware of it when we get into something we call trouble. Of course, our conception of trouble may be different than Mother's, because very often when we get into trouble, we end up making a progress. We end up getting into something better. When Lizzie got into trouble, she ended up as Mistress of Pemberley. When Darcy, and so forth. What do we know of our eternal soul? Our evolution through so many past lives to get to where we are today. Our future evolution and destiny. The spiritual truth of our beings that we're intended to manifest. Why are we here? Why are you here? What did you come for? What are you looking for? What are we doing here? What is our true relationship to the world around us and to the divine being? In all these respects, it's safe to say we are really very ignorant. We rely on our mind as the main instrument for knowledge. And he tells us in this book, and if this book never mentioned the word divine, this would still be the most important, valuable book ever written, simply to explain to human beings the limitations of their own knowledge by the very nature of the mind we live in. No book has ever been written which explained the ignorance the way he has. Mind is an instrument of ignorance. Is there anything mind really knows? He doesn't say that mind is an instrument of inconscience. He doesn't say that mind is totally oblivious of all reality. He doesn't say that. He said it's an instrument of ignorance, meaning there is some knowledge there, but there's a lot that's cloudy, distorted, erroneous, false, imaginary. What is it that's true? What do we really know that's true? He says mind has a capacity for self-consciousness. What can mind really know? What can I really know about myself? I can know that I'm me. I can know that I am. I don't need to look in a mirror. I don't need to consult anyone else. I don't need to try to recall or read. I can know when I wake up in the morning, even with my eyes closed in the middle of the night, I am me. Directly, I know that. I can be conscious of the fact that I am. I may not know who I am or why I am, but I can know that fact directly. What about my self-experience? What can I know directly, for really? I can know I see you. I see you at this minute. You hear me at this moment. It's only a sense impression. But that sense impression is real, is direct. If I feel happy at this minute, I know I feel happy. But if you ask me, what about 5 minutes ago, 3 minutes ago, yesterday, the previous day, last year, I have to consult my encyclopedia. I have to consult my memory. It's like looking through a photograph album. Let me look through the photographs or read my history, and I don't know that directly. If you ask me, what about the next minute? What's going to happen the next minute? What's going to happen an hour from now or tomorrow? I have no direct way of experience to mind. The only thing I can experience directly is this moment. Which moment? Not that moment that I just talked about. That's gone. I can't see it anymore. It's not there anymore to the mind. This moment. This one. Which one? Not that one. This one. It's already gone. It's a dot. It's a dot that's ever changing. And that's the only thing I can experience directly. But just a minute ago, it's already gone. I can't see it anymore. I can't hear it anymore. I can only try to recollect it. My recollection is not direct experience. What about the next one? After all, it's only 1 second ago. 1 second, the next second. Just one look. Can't I look around the corner? 1 second ahead, 1 minute ahead? I don't see anything. It doesn't exist. According to the mind, it doesn't exist yet. How can you see the future? It's not there yet. That's the mind's view. That's the mind's ignorance. We are caught in a box. Or maybe if you imagine that you have a sheet in front of you with a tiny pinhole, and you look through the pinhole at the world, and the only thing you can see is what passes in front of the pinhole. You can't see anything on this side or that side or below or on that side. Ours is a pinhole in time. We call it the moment. Outside of that moment that's here at this instant, we don't know anything. We have a pinhole in space also. I don't know what's going on in back of me. I don't know what's going on above or in next door. Certainly not around the corner or around the world. I'm looking at the whole of the universe from here. I see you. You're looking at the whole of the universe from there. You see me. You don't even see each other. Of course, you look, you can see one thing or another. Another pinhole. We're experiencing the whole universe from one tiny point in space, from our viewpoint, viewing everything that, oh, here she comes with the tea or the coffee. For the people in the other room, there she goes with the tea and the coffee. She's going away. Why is she going away? Everything depends on the pinhole from which we're looking at. The same thing looks different depending on where we look from. This is the instrument of mind, which is the instrument through which we're trying to discover who we are, what the world is, and who the divine is. It's not surprising if we're not doing a great job of it. Mind directly knows only its immediate point in space and time. For everything else, it needs help. It takes second-hand information. The way we read the newspaper or watch the news on TV or listen to the rumors or ask somebody else what happened yesterday or what was that noise I heard downstairs, we all rely on secondhand information for everything outside of that immediate point. A lot of our secondhand information is from our memory. Because if you ask me about my past, if you ask me what happened yesterday or last year or when I was young, I can't experience it anymore. I can't see it anymore. I have to go and look at the photo album. Let me read in the book my records of what happened in the past. And if you ask me about the future, I can't see the future. I have no direct way of knowing it, so I use an instrument we call imagination. I try to imagine the future. Well, I thought I will go afternoon, I'll go to Pondi. Tomorrow I will do this. I'll meet that person. I'll so forth. I'll read this. It's my imagination. Memory on one side, imagination on the other side are instruments we use to compensate for the fact that essentially the mind is ignorant. We have only direct knowledge in a tiny little area. We don't know ourselves. So, why is it we're caught in the moment? Why is it that we can't see the last moment or the next moment? He says because that's the nature of the mind. Our mind divides reality into moments. What do you mean it divides? Moments are real. We think, for us, moments are real. There was a moment, there's a next moment. Here's come one, one's coming, I know it's coming. He says there's no division between one moment and another. There's only a movement. If you sit by a river, you see the water flowing by. But there's no division in the river between the water that's in front of your eye now and the water that was there that's coming behind it or the water that's going. It's a continuous flow. When we read Jane Austen's story or watch the movie for the first time, or the character, when we are the character, if we are Lizzie and she opens Jane's letter, she suddenly says, oh, Lydia is eloped. I never imagined, I never knew it until this minute. Shocking. But we knew that Lydia eloped. We read the book. We not only knew she eloped, we know she's going to get married to Wickham and Darcy's going to come back and propose to her. Jane Austen, when she writes, before she writes this thing, she knows that Lydia elopes. After all, she's conceived of the story. What's the difference between the way Jane Austen understands the story, or the way we understand the story, because we know the whole thing, and the way Lizzie experiences it when she reads that letter? What's the difference between her experience and our experience, or Jane Austen's experience? She's in the ignorance. We're in the knowledge. If we really have the knowledge, our own lives, our own experience, will be like that of Jane Austen, not like that of the character. We'll no longer be locked and confined in this tiny little moment through a pinhole. We'll still have the experience. We have the experience of Pride and Prejudice over and over and over again. It's living for us eternally. When will Pride and Prejudice end? Never. When will Darcy stop proposing to Lizzie or stop loving her? Never. It's there in the timeless field. What a difference between the way we live our moments and the way the divine experiences the knowledge of what's really going on. He says our real self is eternal and infinite being. What does the mind say? My mind tells me, I'm here, I'm in the body. This is my real self. Some time ago I wasn't here, and sometime later I won't be here anymore. But right now I'm here, and this is it. This is the whole thing. What's the difference between the way our mind experiences I and the, what he says is the truth of our being. What's the difference between our ignorance and the knowledge that we should have, that we can have, he tells us. When I say I am me and I am here, do I really know who I am? What I really am doing is I'm experiencing myself. When I say, when you ask me who I am, I said, I'm here, I'm this body. I'm talking about myself as if I'm an object. I point to myself like an object. I think of myself like an object. I'm experiencing myself. I'm not knowing myself. When I close my eyes and wake up in the morning and I say, oh, I'm, now I'm awake, I don't ask who's awake. I am awake, I know. But when I know it directly, but now I'm reflecting on who I am. Well, I'm an American. I came to India. I had this education. I'm doing this work. I'm a mother's devotee and so forth and so on. I'm describing to you my experiences, not who I really am. I'm mostly knowing when I ask you who you are, you tell me your life story or you tell me how you're feeling at the moment. He says, our real self is timeless and eternal. But that real self is also the basis for everything we're experiencing in time. It's the foundation for that experience. It's unchanging. But in our life, everything is changing. Everything's changing every minute. Before I was feeling cool, now I'm feeling warm. Before I was feeling thirsty, now I'm or hungry, now I'm not. Before I was tired, now I'm fresh. Outside and inside, things are constantly changing. But none of that is the self. None of that is my real being. It's all an experience I'm having. It's self-experience. So all that I think is myself is really the experience myself is having. This chapter is trying to tell us what is the significance of that experience. What should I be learning from that experience? Why is this happening to me? If I'm looking at this experience through the pinhole of my mind or from the narrow perspective of my ego, I'm not getting the real significance of what that experience is. And this chapter is to help us become aware and discover the truth, the true meaning of our self-experience in time. He says we have two powers of consciousness. There's a power of knowledge, vidya. That knowledge, we have the capacity for knowledge. That capacity is to know that each of us is the timeless, eternal self that never changes. But also to know that that timeless, eternal self is there in everything and experiencing in everything, and the whole world is only that. It's not a timeless self unconnected with the world. The whole world is a form, an expression, a changing experience of that timeless self. That's our capacity for knowledge. And we have a capacity or a consciousness of ignorance, avidya. And that's what we've been talking about. I think I am in this moment, not in any other moment. I think I am here in this body, not in any other body. I am confined in time, I'm confined in space. And I see everything only from that limited perspective. We not only have a double power of consciousness, but we have a double phase of our consciousness. We can turn inward and become aware, directly aware, of our eternal self. In a moment, rare moment of meditation, we can lose ourselves and really feel we are an infinite being, an eternal being. It's a great spiritual experience. Or we can live on the surface, which we're doing all the time, thinking not that we are the eternal infinite being that created everything and became everything, but thinking we are, I'm Gary, this is Vijaya, Gita, we are each this particular dot in time and space. Our consciousness has both capacities, except we're using one. The rishi who discovers the Brahman, often he goes and loses himself in the other and thinks he's only that and loses contact with this. But we have those both capacities. But Brahman, the reality, the real truth of our being, includes both. We are simultaneously. It's not like now we're in the ignorance and sometime we're going to be in the knowledge. The true being of ours is all the time in the knowledge. If Jane Austen writes the story and creates the character of Elizabeth, and then she becomes an actress and plays the part of Elizabeth in the story and maybe really feels like Elizabeth, she doesn't cease to be Jane Austen. She has the knowledge as the author all the time. She has the knowledge of the whole thing she's created and why she's created it. Even when she's concentrating in the moment, playing the part of Elizabeth and really feeling that she is Elizabeth. So when we say, yes, I'm ignorant, I want the knowledge, we already have the knowledge. Only thing is, we're living in that part of our consciousness which is in the ignorance. We need only move to that part of our consciousness which is in the knowledge. There's not two of us. And it's not in succession. It's a question, are we going to live on the surface in the ignorance, or are we going to help that surface become aware of what we already know in the depths? For the divine, for our true being, it always knows. It knows all. It knows beyond the all. It raises a question. Why do we seek this experience? Why, if our true being is knowledge, why should we go and jump in the muddy pond, get all dirty and wet and cold? What are we doing here? What are we trying to accomplish here? If your true being is eternal, immortal, infinite, all-powerful, why should we possibly take on this limited, ignorant incapacity? We know he has told us that our ignorance is the result of the one manifesting itself by involving itself in the inconscient, by hiding its knowledge in the inconscient, and that knowledge gradually awakening through an evolution to self-knowledge, And in one stage of that awakening, we have the plant which can only sense the stimuli of heat or water or food. And then we have the animal that has a subconscious knowledge around it, can feel fear, can see a prey, has the instincts to survive. And now we have emerged as self-conscious mental human beings. So many complexities and complications that the animals don't have. And from here, we're supposed to go and rise to the supermental knowledge so that we can be people, individuals in the body, but still have knowledge of our infinite immortal being. We can be here individually expressing uniquely something for which our soul is destined. Being aware of the infinite totality, but also being aware of our individuality and the individuality of every other form. So for the divine, he's told us, this ignorance has a purpose. This ignorance has a direction. We're not just trying to go back to something where we came from. We're trying to create something. We're trying to create something that didn't exist before. And he says our destiny is to be the divine in the individual body, each of us uniquely, infinitely the divine. He also tells us the origin of our self-experience. Why we're having the experience we're having. He says it's all predestined. It's all determined in the supermind. Say, why is Lydia elope with Wickham? Jane Austen wrote that story that way. She decided that way. All that manifests pre-exists. It pre-exists in our consciousness, not in our surface consciousness. It pre-exists. In our infinite consciousness. Only thing is, we are not acting like Jane Austen now, who's written the story. We're acting like the character in the story who's at one point. Even though, in one sense, we have written the story. Mother says nothing can happen that the soul doesn't sanction and the supreme doesn't sanction. Whatever experience we're going through, our deepest being has sanctioned this experience because that experience is to serve a purpose. And the whole question of this chapter, what purpose is it serving? And is it serving the intended purpose? And how can we get the most knowledge out of that experience? It raises a question. Does the divine really need experience? If we are an infinite, eternal being, do we really gain something from experience? And what can we gain from that experience? If Jane Austen writes the story, why does Jane Austen write the story? If she can imagine the story, why should she write it? And if she writes it, why should she take the part of Elizabeth and act it out? Does she gain something from that she didn't have before she wrote the story? She's created the experience in her own imagination. Why? Does she benefit from that in some way? If she lives out that experience, is she different in some way because she's lived it out? Well, let's first look at the experience from the way we experience it. If we're not getting the most out of our experience, what are we getting out of our experience? How do we evaluate our own experience? Well, the first thing that's pretty clear is I judge everything from my own perspective.
Sir, this is Sri Ranjini. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Sir, in your analogy of Jane Austen's creation, this is my opinion. Kindly correct me if my understanding is wrong. The story of Pride and Prejudice is based on certain life experiences, and it's her imagination of things. She expected a love, a true love, like how Lizzie and Darcy had, and she basically puts up small experiences in her life, and then she creates this story. So at one point of time, she experiences that particular character. So I'm not quite sure, like when you say that she has the entire knowledge about the story, but it's just that her imagination, she's not like the divine where she gets some kind of pleasure or a delight by writing the entire experiences. That this is not like something that she knows what it is. It's just that her pure imagination that she's just putting it as a story. She thinks that, okay, this is how the marriage should happen, or this is how five girls would end up getting married. So I'm not quite understanding how you could relate it to how the delight of the divine to her experience. So it's just an analogy. I'm just trying to understand in that perspective. Like, why do you say that this is like how... I know that you give this example. This is more like understanding it in a simpler way. But still, I'm not convinced that any author, even a scientific experiment that a scientist does, it is just to prove a point that, okay, this could be a probability. But that's not how the divine works, right?
It's a very good point you've made. In that statement, I was using Jane Austen as an analogy for the divine. Let's actually think about what Jane Austen does, but I was trying to use it as an analogy because the difference between the knowledge of Jane Austen and her character is a parallel to the knowledge that the divine has or our eternal being has and the knowledge of what we're experiencing on the surface. I was trying to use it as a comparison because we don't have that direct experience of the infinite consciousness, but we can imagine that of the author. So your point is well taken. But let's think about it from Jane Austen's point of view as an author. Still, the point will help us. Why does she write the story? The story is an experience for her. It's an imaginative experience. The characters are not real physically, but they're real in her. They're creations of her imagination. And anyone who thinks that that Elizabeth Bennet is not doesn't exist and has no reality. I think if you poll the world, there are a lot more people who know about Elizabeth Bennet than know about any of us. She exists. She may not exist in a physical body. But Jane Austen has created something in her imagination. Why? Many authors write because they want to earn money. I think she got paid only £10 for that story. That story may have earned hundreds of millions for the people who made movies about it, but Jane Austen certainly didn't make money. Many authors write for popularity, but she actually wrote it under a pseudonym because women weren't supposed to write books at that time, under a pen name. And the book really only became famous after her death. She became famous after her death, and she's become really famous only 200 years later. So she didn't get the popularity. Maybe she wrote it for the sheer joy of self-expression. Maybe life was boring out in the countryside where she was living. There's no handsome men coming. There are no dances. There's no romance. There's no drama. So maybe she exercised her creative imagination for that. Or maybe she was looking for some knowledge which was not coming to her in her own physical experience, and she had an urge to try to imagine what it would be like. And this is my imagination now. I'm not speaking the facts. But she was not married. Like every young girl of that age at that time, it's natural that she was thinking about marriage and like wondering who would be the special person who would come and sweep her off her feet and give her a romantic fulfillment. But she looks all around her. She looks at her father and her mother. Maybe their relationship was not much different than Mr. and Mrs. Bennet, or Sir William and Lady Lucas. She looks at the men around her, and maybe a lot of them are not much more romantic or appealing than Mr. Collins, or Mr. Hurst, or Mr. Bennet, who she loves as a father, but not certainly a romantic ideal of what a young woman would want. Or Bingley, who's very friendly and a very good dancer, but he's kind of a silly man. She's an intelligent lady, and it's hard to make Bingley a romantic ideal. He's too silly. Or maybe it's a rich, handsome, important man like Darcy who never smiles, who looks more like a piece of wood. And maybe she's wondering, is there really a man in the world who could give me an emotional, romantic fulfillment, and what would be my life like with him? Maybe she couldn't imagine that perfect man. Maybe the most she could do was imagine that one of the types of men she already knows tries his best to become perfect in her eyes. Maybe she imagines telling some of these men, you see, you have many nice qualities, but you do this silly thing, or this mean thing, or this selfish thing, or this arrogant thing, or this pride thing. Why don't you change that, and then I will love you? Appa's theory is that she wrote Pride and Prejudice to outgrow marriage. That her romantic ideal would not be fulfilled through marriage. She had an ideal. She's a developed mind and a developed personality, and marriage would not fulfill that. She wrote this story in order to outgrow the need for that thing which doesn't really exist in that way. It's a theory. But having written the story, what did she get out of it? Just because Darcy and Elizabeth never existed, just because nobody married in real life, doesn't mean that she didn't get some experience out of writing the story. Some real experience, really valid for her own progress as Jane Austen. When she writes about Jane and Bingley, and obviously she has a deep affection for the character Jane, who reminds her of her real sister in life, and she says, you see, Jane's very mild, very good, never thinks anything wrong, and finally she gets what she wants. Her patience is fulfilled. She learns through that. What does Jane teach? Jane teaches us, be patient. Be patient. What doesn't come now can come later. She wrote about Charlotte. Charlotte's not an ideal person. But what does she learn, Jane Austen learn, by writing and imagining about Charlotte? You see, even if she's plain, even if she's 27, even if nobody notices her, a person of goodwill who brings good things to other people will have good things coming to them. She may not have formulated this in her mind, but in her creative imagination, thinking about the life of Jane and Charlotte, something in her, if you ask her, what did you learn from the story? No, no, it was just a story. But actually, if you knew her, if you could look into her personality, you would see. You see, after writing this story, you're a little bit more patient than before. You're a little more generous to other people than before. What did she learn from Lizzie? The value of courage and cheerfulness. You know, I don't know what it is, Jane Austen, but you seem to be happier nowadays. And you seem to be, you're not so afraid of things. You seem to be more bold. Yes, well, maybe it came because I wrote that story of Elizabeth Bennet. She's so courageous, it inspires me. I want to be like her. So even though it's a completely imaginary story, imaginary means in the physical world, it's not imaginary really. It really gives her an experience. Okay, here's a non-real event which gave her a real experience in her imagination. What about for the actors and actresses who perform this unreal story in a movie or on the stage? Imagine the character who plays Elizabeth, who says, "My courage comes out when I'm challenged," who goes face to face with Lady Catherine, blow for blow, and comes out victorious. Who's able to frankly tell this man, "You're the last man on earth I would ever marry." Jennifer Ailey, who was the actress who played it in the BBC version, says that she felt like a different person for 6 months after playing this part, meaning she became a little different person. Though she was acting, the acting out the character of Elizabeth, which is such a pleasant, courageous, energetic, cheerful character, changed her in some way. It not only changed her, it changed Darcy, Colin Firth, to the point that they actually fell in love with each other for a short time. Who did they fall in love with? Elizabeth fell in, Jennifer fell in love with Darcy, not with Colin. Colin fell in love with Elizabeth, not with Jennifer. It was a real experience for them. What about us when we read the story? Is it completely a fiction? Is it completely just an imagination with no relevance? I don't know about you, but I feel Jane Austen's story has changed my life. Huh? What's that? With Lizzie. Only with Lizzie, huh? I can identify with more of the characters than that. Prefer. You'd prefer it to have relevance. But we have the potential of extracting valuable self-experience out of all the experience of the characters in that story. Isn't that what we're doing? Isn't that why Appa's writing about this silly romance for the last 5 or 6 years? Isn't that why we're talking about it in every meeting? If there's really no knowledge there for us, if there's no valuable experience there for us, we won't be wasting our time. Every time I think about the fact, you see, Wickham goes and slanders Darcy for no fault of Darcy, for nothing essentially wrong, but he does a great service to Darcy by his false abuse. He helps Darcy shed his arrogance, his pride, his selfishness, and become a better and a happier man. It made a very big impression on me. Even if somebody accuses you falsely, which is what Shervindo says, even if they accuse you of something wrong, there's a value in their accusation. There's something that we should learn from it. And maybe we should learn more from the false accusation than the true accusation. Doesn't matter whether it's false or true. Because even when everything Wickham said to Darcy about Darcy was wrong, Darcy, if he's sincere, has to feel Wickham may be wrong in his accusations, but there are plenty of things that I'm doing wrong, that I am wrong about. So what he said may be wrong, but that doesn't make me right. Just because he's wrong doesn't make me right. I am wrong also. And if Lizzie sees that Mrs. Bennet is wrong in her behavior, doesn't make her right. Yes, yes, I'm always complaining. My mother is talking about the red coats, but the fact is I also was attracted to the red coat. My sister ran away with the red coat, but I was also thinking, wouldn't it be nice to run away with the red coat? So without having to actually run away with the red coat to find out he's a scoundrel and that's a dead end, just by seeing her sister do it, oh, I'm glad I don't have to go through that humiliating experience. I can learn from what my sister did. Really learn. In fact, she could have learned from what Darcy told her about Georgiana. Darcy told her that Wickham tried to elope with Georgiana. She refused to learn from it. Because she refused to learn from the story, the true story, that true story in the story, about Georgiana and Wickham, she had to learn from her own sister actually eloping and almost ruining the family. Well, what about us? What can we learn from that? In other words, we can learn not only from our experience, which we don't do a very good job of most of the time, like Mrs. Bennett. What did she learn from her experience? Essentially, you can sum it up this way. Everybody else is wrong, right? At the end of the story, what has she learned? Next time when Kitty goes to Brighton, I must go with her. No? The chances are not only Kitty will elope, even Mrs. Bennett may elope. She has not learned anything. We admire Mr. Bennett, we admire Lizzie, we admire Darcy, because they have learned from their own experience. We can learn from all their experience. If this story is popular and famous after 200 years, it's because why people keep watching it now? Why people keep reading it? Why we keep talking? Because there's so much we can learn from it. Really learn from it as experience. Well, if that's true, so we have our own direct lives we can learn from. But we can also learn from everything that happens to everybody around us. We can also learn from everything that's been written about everybody, whether it's in history or in biology, biography, or in literature, because... And that's why literature is so great, because it shares with us experience of other people in a way that we can derive, we get the fruit, the juice out of the fruit of somebody else's life, somebody else's insight, somebody else's wisdom. And if Shakespeare is so immortally famous, it's because he gives more of that wisdom. Sherbindo called him a seer of life. He sees life. He's giving us in each line, in each word, in each episode, in all, knowledge that we can take to be better. Darcy gets it by abuse, by being abused by her. We can get it by reading and extracting that knowledge. So, whether we're Jane Austen writing a story for self-experience, or an actress like Jennifer playing a part for self-experience, or we're actually reading the book to get the self-experience, or we're living it in our day-to-day work or life, or we're observing other people and their lives and listening to them, we are surrounded by self-experience, rich knowledge. An infinite knowledge waiting for us to help us awaken. And the interesting thing is, each of us, it's like God wrote a novel for each of us, a separate novel. We each get our own specialized experience. No two peoples are the same. Even if we're together all the time in the same rooms with the same people, it means something different to each of us. Because each of us has another discovery to make. This self-experience is gold. not physical gold. It is physical gold. It's spiritual gold. It's grace. How well are we using it? Like the blind man, when Shiva drops the gold bars on the road, we are constantly looking, where is Shiva? He's ignoring me. We're walking past an infinite riches at every minute, especially when somebody abuses us or accuses us or neglects us, which we don't like very much, or forgets us. We're missing at every moment the valuable experience that our soul wants, that our soul has orchestrated, written the story of our lives, so we should go through this and get the knowledge from it. Well, if we're missing this, why are we missing it? If I'm not getting the real essence of the knowledge that I should get out of it, what am I getting out of it? Let's take when Collins proposes to Lizzie, what is the knowledge that Collins gets out of it? What's his experience? What has he experienced? I'm insulted. I'm humiliated. I'm embarrassed. I'm angry. I have an urge to hurt these people who have made me look small and foolish. That stupid Mrs. Bennett who has encouraged me to propose to this strong-headed, willful, stupid girl who doesn't know how valuable I am, who insults me by refusing my proposal, even though she may never get another one. This Bennett family, I don't know why I came here. My father was right to quarrel with Mr. Bennett. Let me get out of here. Now I have to recover my prestige. I can't go back to Lady Catherine and say I've been made a fool of. I've got to get engaged. Let me go and find somebody who will marry me. And he gets Charlotte. What has he learned from his self-experience? How has he digested it and summarized it? Mrs. Bennett's a stupid lady. Elizabeth is a flighty, silly girl. The Bennets are low people. And afterwards, when he hears about Lydia's elopement, yes, see how lucky I am. See how lucky I escaped those people of low consciousness. It's grace that has come to me. What is he doing? He's looking at his self-experience from the viewpoint of his ego. He's defending himself. He's finding fault with everybody around him and saying that Lydia is a wayward, horrible girl, that mother is no mother. This Elizabeth is arrogant. He's finding fault with all of them. And about himself, I'm perfect. Right? I'm right. I'm right, the world is wrong. And he convinces himself that it's grace that Lizzie refused him, that God has spared him from the folly, but he refuses to learn anything about himself that will help him become a better person. Is he a better person after that? Do we see that he's made any progress after that refusal that has made him a better person? Has he learned anything about himself? Now compare it when Darcy proposes to her.
May I ask a question?
Ashok, you wanted to say something?
Yes.
Please go ahead.
You said that even while slander was by Vikram about Darcy, was in a way helpful to Darcy in his effort to come out of his pride and selfishness and egocentricism and all that. In this context, I would like to ask you something. I see in the papers that the Islamic world, particularly the PLO and the Iranian government and the Muslim jihadist outfits and all, they are constantly criticizing the US government for being one-sided and being partial to Israel and being insensitive to the plight of the Arabs and supporting Israeli war efforts and all that. This has been going on for many years. Do you think all this criticism voiced by the Islamic world about the U.S. in the UN General Assembly is in any way helpful to the U.S. government and would help to keep the U.S. government function properly?
What's true for Darcy is true for not only the U.S. government or the Israeli or the Indian or anyone else. For each of us, there is something that we should learn from not only our own experience, but from the experience of everyone else. If a news comes to us, if an information comes to us, it has significance to us. That we see in the story. When she read that Wickham had tried to elope with Georgiana, she didn't realize, well, what does that have to do with me? I have nothing to do with that. She said, no, this has nothing to do. She ignored it. Every information that comes to us has some significance for us. There's something we can learn from it. If you're asking whether the U.S. is learning what they should learn from it, I think clearly, no country is consciously learning what they should learn. But which individual are we? Right now, we're at the level, what are we learning from our own experience? You normally, an individual can be much more conscious than a group. And countries are not known to be conscious. They acquire their experience subconsciously. Say, when you know... my thought on this, that when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan around 1980 and the U.S. said, how can we stymie the Soviets and frustrate them, they came up with this very clever idea that they can arm and train the Mujahideen and let them fight the battle. Now, what is the experience the U.S. has been? We fought our longest war ever in history in Afghanistan, fighting the people that we armed and trained. If you ask me, has the U.S. learned this? I'm not sure. But if you ask me whether there's a lesson here for the U.S. to learn and the world to learn, certainly. I would rather have the Soviets in Afghanistan than the Mujahideen fundamentalists there. We would have made much more progress, and they would have too. So certainly there is some, your question shows what's true for an individual is true for a country, is true for the whole world. There is something we should learn from all our self-experience. Sri Aurobindo would say, what should India have learned from Jallianwalabagh? Should have learned that these people are not going to go peacefully. The British are here violently, and they should be violently expelled from India. We didn't learn that, and we went through another 27 years, in order to gain independence, and then had to fight have hundreds of thousands of people die during partition, because we didn't learn that sometimes it's necessary to stand up and fight. So let's not worry about the U.S., which is not any more conscious as a nation than others, but the principle is wonderful. It's true for the country, it's true for the individual, it's true for the family. In other words, Our whole lives are filled with pride and prejudices. We're taking only one and making it a common experience so that we can share and learn together. But for every pride and prejudice that we have, we each have 100 novels that are going on, 100 dramas that are going on in our own lives. Are we learning from them? So the question that I was trying to address is, if Collins did not learn from his experience, why? And then I was saying, well, look at Darcy. When Darcy proposed to her, and rather foolishly and certainly rudely, though he wasn't trying to be rude, but he certainly was rude, and she said, I made up my mind long ago, within a month of meeting you, you're the last man on earth I would ever marry. You're selfish and mean and arrogant and boorish. She used a little different words, but that was the essential message. What did Darcy do? What was his self-experience? What would I have done if I were Darcy? Well, we know what Collins would have done. The first thing Collins would have done is to say, you see, she believed the lies of that scoundrel. She believed that handsome man who's telling lies about me. She's a foolish girl. I must completely ignore everything she said. And I made a mistake in proposing to her. I better get out of here as quickly as possible. He has real justification if he wants to justify himself. He has real justification. After all, what did I say that wasn't true? Mrs. Bennet is acting in such a boorish, ugly way. She's sitting there at the Netherfield ball talking about bringing rich men and for her daughters and everything. Shamelessly mercenary. Lydia and Kitty are running around and dancing in a most unbecoming way. They have no manners to them. Elizabeth is provoking me about Darcy, about Wickham, and talking about this Wickham just because he has a handsome coat and a handsome face. He's a scoundrel, and she doesn't have the common sense or the goodness to see through his appearance and see what he is. I should never have come to Meryton. I was attracted to her for some reason. I don't know. I got to get out of here and go back to London as soon as possible. That's not what he says. He doesn't justify himself. He doesn't say, these are all the reasons I'm right and she's wrong. He ignores all the things that are wrong about what she said. All right, it's true that she believed his lies. It doesn't matter. Is there a truth in what she said is the only question. All right, I had a good intention, but my behavior... what she says is true. I didn't talk in a gentlemanly way. All right, everything Wickham said was wrong. But it's also true. She says I'm selfish. She says I'm arrogant. She says I've been mean. She's accusing me of interfering between Bingley and Jane. Well, I thought I was proud of interfering between Bingley and Jane to save my friend. But now, what's the idea of telling Bingley that he can't marry Jane and then I want to marry the sister? Doesn't sound very sincere to me. I'm inconsistent. Yes. She says I'm the last man. In her eyes, I'm so proud, I'm so ugly, I'm so terrible, I'm so disgusting. He uses that word. Well, now that I see, I'm so disgusting to you. Is there anything disgusting about me? He went back and spent months thinking about it, accepting what was true, throwing out the rest. Okay, she's also ignorant. There's a lot of... but what's the truth in what she said? Rather... what's the truth in the self-experience that I've had by being abused? There's so much he can learn from that. How could I propose to a girl who hates me and I never realized it? Why didn't I realize that she hates me? How could I be so stupid? There must be a reason. Oh-ho, now I understand. I'm so proud of myself that I assumed everybody wants to marry me. Oh, she says, I'm blind, I'm egoistic. In fact, the truth of the matter is, I never thought about what she thinks of me. I'm only thinking about what I think of her. I think that's the definition of selfishness. That's ego. I never thought whether she'll be happy marrying me. I was only thinking, I want her. I see the object, now I want her. I've convinced myself. So I take it. It's one thing to buy a car or a mango because you want it. It's another thing to take another human being and try to possess them for the rest of your life without ever thinking whether it's good for them. That way I'm like Collins. That's what, when I heard Collins proposing to Elizabeth, it was so foolish. How could Elizabeth ever be happy with a man like Collins? That was obvious. But it never occurred to me, how could Elizabeth be happy with a man like me? It never occurred to me that the truth of the matter is, I've never said one really pleasant thing to Elizabeth. We've never had one moment where we smiled or laughed together. Yes, yes, the more I think about this, the more foolish I feel, the more blind I've been, the more proud and arrogant and selfish I've been. So what is he doing? He's getting outside himself, not outside himself. He's putting his own behavior at a distance from him, and he's examining his own behavior impartially, without defending himself, without just justifying himself, like he's a third person, and saying, I don't like this, I don't like this, I don't like this, this is not good, this is terrible, this is disgusting. She was right. And then he has the sincerity to say, I'm going to change. So what's the difference between the way Collins has his self-experience and Darcy has a much more unpleasant experience, because she only ran away from Collins. Here she attacked him, though he really deserved it. So what's the truth of our self-experience? How do we value our self-experience? For Collins, it's very clear. I propose, she said no, I failed. Failure is wrong. If anything, if I try something and it fails, I'm wrong. It's wrong. It's bad. Failure is bad, right? Is failure bad? Failure must be bad, no? Because we're all the time looking for success. Nobody's looking for failure. All the time we're counting up. Oh, I tried this, it worked. I tried that, it failed. That's bad, this is good. Mother must make everything I do a success, right? Success is good. Failure is bad, right? But Darcy's greatest value came from a failure. How do we reconcile that? How do we explain that? The ego looks at everything from its point of view and says success is good, failure is bad. When Lizzie meets Wickham, she said, he's so pleasant to me. I like him. I feel good. I feel nice. That's good, right? This man Darcy, he makes me feel intimidated. I feel uncomfortable. I think he's judging me. That's bad, right? So Wickham is where I should be, not Darcy, right? The ego judges everything from the superficial point of view of success and failure, pleasant or unpleasant. So Lizzie came to that wonderful statement, immortal statement, that anybody who's that handsome must be good. That's what she believed about Wickham. Meaning, she, with all her intelligence and insight, doesn't know the difference between a handsome face and a good character. So how should she reflect when she finds out that Wickham has gone after Mary King for £10,000. What should she understand? When she reads the letter that says Wickham tried to elope with Georgiana, which is a betrayal of the whole Darcy family, what should she understand? Oh, A handsome face doesn't mean a good character. I should have learned that. It's a very valuable lesson. But what does the average girl learn, or the average person learn? I thought he liked me, now he's gone after Mary King, I lost the handsome man. Now I feel my prestige has gone down, I don't get what I want. Because, in other words, we judge our self-experience not from the point of view of the knowledge that our soul wants to get. We judge our self-experience whether it inflates the ego, whether it's pleasant on the surface. But we see in the story that the unpleasant experience may be the most valuable experience that not only makes us wiser, but makes us better. It's through their negative experience that Lizzie has risen to Pemberley, that she has outgrown the low mother's consciousness in her, the impulses of a Lydia. Only after the news of Lydia's elopement does she really reflect deeply on herself and say, you see, I should have told my father about Wickham. I didn't want to because I still have a soft corner for him. Because I have a soft corner for him, tragedy has come to my family. I can't afford to be like my mother or my sister, even inside, even as an impulse. I must know it's wrong for me to feel or think what they do. I shouldn't be like them. I should outgrow that. She outgrows her family consciousness in that measure. So if we look at our own self-experience from that point of view, Appa says that for 30, 40 years after the fact, memories are coming back to him. People are suddenly coming back into his mind. Why is that man? I haven't thought of that man for 30, 40 years or that incident. Why does it come back? He says, because there's still some knowledge that I have not gotten from that experience. There's still something more I should learn from it. And when I fully extract the knowledge from my own self-experience of the past, that memory will go. Not only the memory will go, but that type of experience will never come back again because it has no utility for us. So if we are constantly feeling, why does this thing always happen to me? Why do I always get in trouble? Why do I always end up with people who tell me lies and I believe them and then get in trouble later, or I make promises and I can't keep those promises later, or whatever it is. If there's any recurring pattern in our life, why is it recurring? What is this conspiracy? Why is Mother doing this to me? Why is she punishing me like this? Why am I having the bad luck? The answer in all these cases is the same answer. Because there's something I should learn from this. Why is my sister eloping, or whatever it is that's happening in my family or in me or in other people around me? Because there's something I should learn from this. There's a progress I should make here. Not because I'm a bad person and I must become a good person, because I'm ignorant and I should discover the knowledge. My soul, I should discover the soul, the truth of my being. I should become more and more an instrument of Mother. I should know that Mother's in me. I should be an embodiment of Mother. All my experiences without exception are only coming to me to help me, guide me, point to me. You want to make a progress? Here. You want to make it? Here. It's not a challenge. It's not a test. Mother doesn't test anybody. It's a help for us. And if we can get that help by reading it in a story and learn the experience in a story, we need not go through it in our life. Or if we hear it in another person, oh, they must have done something bad to have that experience. It's very hard not to judge another person. Oh, yeah, they're having that trouble means there must be something that they need to learn from it. That's not the thing we should be thinking. What should we learn from it? If somebody else is having the experience and we hear about it, it has some relevance to us. Our job is not to say that person should make a progress in their life and their solve their problem. What progress can I make? This experience comes to me. I read it in a story, I read it in the newspaper, I experience it from a friend or a devotee, it has a relevance to me. So every minute of my life, and if nothing's happening around, if I'm all alone for 3 days, there's nobody at home, there's nothing going on, I'm not meeting anybody, nothing's happening, I still have my own memories. I have so many years of experience that I have not extracted the knowledge from. And that's what consecration is. That's why Appa talks about the power of consecration. Because we have so much of rich experience behind us that we have not, it's like a piling up of all the food, but we're not eating it. We're feeling hungry, but we've not eaten what's there already in the pantry. We have so much of money in the bank. We're thinking, where can I get more money? We have so much saved up that we're not spending because it's there. We don't, every experience we've had, every memory has something to offer us. And he's given us, I'd say Appa has given us, the technology for extracting the juice from the fruit. And it turns out, when you squeeze a fruit, you get the juice and that's it. But it turns out this fruit has layer and layer and layer and layer of juice. And if you squeeze out all of the juice from any one event, you'll feel Mother just exploding in your heart because you can go all the way to the divine. You can go all the way from the superficial consciousness to the divine through any one experience, through any one event. What is that method that he calls consecrating the past? Okay, I want to consecrate the past. I had a bad experience, or I had a good experience. That's also, whether it's a good or bad experience doesn't matter. The question is, have I gotten the knowledge I should get out of it? If something went right, have I got all the knowledge I should get out of that so everything goes right? If something went wrong, have I got all the knowledge out of that so nothing ever goes wrong and I can accomplish anything I want at any moment? Not only at this level, but at the next level. So what's the method? He's given us the method. Start by the past experience is past. He's told us in the ignorance of our mind, it doesn't exist anymore. But he's also told us, in fact, Sri Aurobindo writes in this chapter, the past is ever present. The past is never past. It's always there. If you talk about the future to the mind, it says, the future doesn't exist yet. He says, the future already exists. It has not appeared before the pinhole yet. The future is here in every minute. We determine the future by what we are in the present. Our present is determined by what we have been in the past. So by consecrating at this moment, I can change my past and change my future. And that's consecration of the past. How do we do it? Well, take an experience that you had, whether you were 5 or 10 or 15 or 35, doesn't matter. What's something that comes to your mind that you know there's something? Well, the first thing we do is, let me remember what happened. Remembering the experience is, my analogy is, it's like looking in a photograph album. What's the difference between the photograph and the experience? Just because somebody takes a photograph of this meeting and sees our faces, how much have they gotten out of the meeting? It's a very superficial thing. It's like I want to learn more about myself, so I go and look in the mirror. What am I going to learn about myself looking in the mirror? I simply see the most superficial thing on the outside, whereas everything I really need to know is inside. Darcy won't learn anything about himself looking in the mirror except to notice that he's frowning all the time. Wickham, when he looks in the mirror, only admires his hair and his smile, but doesn't learn anything about his character. So, but we start past consecration by reviewing the memory, which may be very superficial. This is what I was wearing that day. This was what the weather was raining that day. This is the people I saw that day. Or maybe I had a headache that day. Whatever it is, I remember the superficial sense impressions. If you consecrate those to Mother, what happens? You begin to remember, this is what I was thinking. When I met that man, I was wondering, is he after my money? Is he an honest man? Then I consecrate all the thoughts that come up. Then I remember, yes, yes, the first time I met the man, I had a fear. I had a fear. See, my fear is proved true. He's betrayed. Did my fear prove to be true, or did my fear create the betrayal? I should consecrate my fear. Why did I have a fear? It's not only this man I'm afraid of. I was afraid of that man, and it also ran into trouble. I was suspicious of that man, and I was, yes, I'm a suspicious character. I don't trust people. So all the time I'm asking Mother to protect me from unreliable people, but actually the thing I should be protected from is my suspicion. I should give up my suspicion. I should consecrate my character of suspicion. So I go from the superficial sense impression, he was wearing that and I was wearing this, it was cold or it was hot, to what I was thinking, to what I was feeling, to what in me is the source of those types of feelings or thoughts, those attitudes. I have this opinion, I have that attitude, I have this character. And at each level, life opens up. If I have a problem, the moment my consecration, all I have to do, I simply have to offer this to Mother. This is, I offer that bad thought to Mother, I offer this feeling to Mother. Mother, please dissolve my fear, please dissolve my suspicion. I give it up, I don't accuse anybody of anything. Let me be pure. I rely on you. I shouldn't rely on anybody. He was a rich man, so I relied on him. I shouldn't rely on anybody. I should only rely on you. Last week, we are having a meeting, which we'll announce later on, overseas, a course on individuality and accomplishment. Last week, I was wanting to think how we could bring some more people to the course. So Sweta suggested, I was praying to Mother for that. And somebody came out of the blue and offered they want to participate in the course. Then Sweta suggested that we can market it on Facebook and put advertisement. I never knew you could do that on Facebook. That's a wonderful idea. I got very excited about it. And we started talking about the ad. Chandrasekharan very politely said, see, it's better we rely on Mother, not on the ad. Sweta did 100 ads all over the internet. Nothing came. Then I remembered a few days later, you see, Chandrasekhar said we shouldn't rely on the Facebook, we should rely on Mother. The moment I decided to withdraw from the Facebook, we got more response. So everything is like that. There's nothing that's not like that for us. Every experience, the failure, should I be sorry that I didn't get the response? I should be grateful that life reminded me of what's really valuable, where the real power is. So the whole issue of this chapter is, why is experience coming to us? It's coming to us. The soul has taken birth for experience. It's not like this is a good experience and that's a bad experience and how do I get more of these and less of these. Whatever is coming to us has a value for us. The only question is, do I get the knowledge I should get out of that experience? Do I make the progress I should make out of that experience? And how do we do that? He tells us how to do that. First of all, we have to detach from the core, the sources of our ignorance. What's the source of the ignorance? I live in the mind. What does the mind do? It looks at everything divided. It looks at everything in terms of opposites. I'm right, he's wrong. That's the mind's way. It divides everything out. What's good for him is bad for me. And I look at it from the ego. I look at it from the point of view of what I like, what's pleasing to me, what raises my self-importance or my prestige or my wealth or my power is good. And anything that humiliates me, like her abuses, is bad. I have to get away from looking at the world in terms of these divisions. I have to get away from looking at everything from my point of view. So Appa's telling us over and over and over again, what? Take the other person's point of view. What's the value of that? The value of that is when we take the other person's point of view, we get the knowledge that we're supposed to get. Not because the other person's right and we're wrong, because we're ignorant, because we're caught in the people. Because another person's point of view gives us knowledge that we don't have. And so at every minute, you say, well, I'm very sincere, I want to have knowledge, I want mother, please tell me what knowledge I should get out of this. Just discover the truth in everybody else's point of view. Not that, please. Please, I want knowledge, but not to... Don't tell me that everybody's right. She's always complaining about me. She's always finding fault. That must be, that cannot be knowledge. No, no. Give me some knowledge which doesn't give any credit to the other people. That's the kind of knowledge I want. So at every minute, can we say we can't find out what other people are thinking and feeling and what their viewpoint is? Can we stop for 1 minute? In the story, it's very striking. Jane is such a sweet person. Her intentions are so good. She never thinks of another person. She never thinks of Lizzie. It's a revelation the first time I realized it. She's all the time trying to be good, but she's always trying to say, I must be good, I must be good. She's all the time trying to raise her own self-image in her own mind that she's good. She's not thinking about her sister who loves her so much, who's living for her, who gives up marriage for Jane's sake. No, I won't marry you. You have interfered with my beloved sister, Jane. How could I marry you? Jane's not thinking of what somebody else is doing. So we have the knowledge. If we really want the self-experience, if we want the knowledge from the self-experience, we can have it. We know we can have it. There's a lot more in this chapter, which will come back in the next chapter. If we want the knowledge that experience gives us, we have to first separate from the experience and not say, I am my experience. When somebody says that I'm arrogant, I get angry. I get so angry. You know that story? Mentioned it. Appa told me. I read it a long time ago. Jay Krishnamurti was in the U.S. and he was talking about giving a lecture on ego and how to shed the ego. And after the lecture, one man came up to him and said, I have shed my ego. And Krishnamurti said, really? Yes, I have. Really? Yes, I have. Really? You have shed your ego? Yes, I have shed my ego. Then what's getting angry here? Then who's getting angry here? If you have shed your ego, there's nothing to get angry. So, whatever we say, sometimes I know I'm angry, but I don't express it. But when we really get angry, we don't even know we're angry. We just become anger. What is Lizzie doing? She's giving us the technology or the technique. She's telling us how we get knowledge out of our experience. Detach yourself from your experience. Put it at a distance. Instead of blaming other people and complaining against them, look at your own experience of yourself as if it's a second person. It's called detachment, the spiritual discipline. And she does that. She rises, as Appa has said, from being in the vital anger and energy and confusion. She rises to her mind and looks at her own vital. And she says, I've been acting absurdly. And then she says, I never knew myself till now. Meaning, she's been living in the vital, reacting to things, enjoying them or reacting to them, but not reflecting on herself. And now she rises to the mind and looks at her own behavior. And she knows herself differently. She becomes more self-conscious. And this is the method of becoming self-conscious. What does Appa tell us all the time? Not just Appa, Sri Aurobindo and Mother say all the time. They say, the first thing you should do if you want to make a progress is don't react. Why? Why shouldn't I react? That man called me a liar. Why shouldn't I react? This person accused me of something that wasn't true. Why shouldn't I react? I'm right, they're wrong. I react. It's right. You can't deprive me of that right. Why shouldn't I react? She gave tea or coffee or food to everybody. She didn't give to me. I have a right to be angry. Why shouldn't I react? Because as long as I react, I'm in the vital experience. I can't get the knowledge out of it. What a wisdom there is in that simple thing, which we know how difficult it is to do. As long as you're part of the problem, you can't be part of the solution. As long as I'm defending myself and accusing other people, I'm missing the real value of the experience to me. Not only do we miss that value, but we defend our right to miss that value. We defend our right to react. We defend our right and say the other person is wrong. Mother's trying to give us prosperity and we're trying to defend our prestige. That's what Collins did. That's what Darcy didn't. He understood the knowledge is really valuable. It doesn't matter what form it comes in. It doesn't matter who's right or wrong. I should get the knowledge. So, she detaches from the vital. She tries to stop reacting, which is very difficult. She's not a yogi. She's not a mother's devotee. So, but she does it very sincerely. But what do we see? Why is non-reaction so powerful? Because the experience comes to us for a knowledge. The moment we stop reacting, we begin to get the knowledge. The experience has no need. We have no need for that experience anymore in the measure we get the knowledge. So I think everybody who's tried it has seen, the more you refuse to react to an experience, the problem goes away. It doesn't make any sense. What is my reacting or not reacting have to do with the solution to the problem? Because the moment I refuse to react to what's coming to me, I begin to get the knowledge that's supposed to come to me from that experience. And when I do that, the experience is over because the experience has come to give me a knowledge. This is what he's telling us in this chapter. So now we understand why taking the other person's point of view is valuable, why non-reaction is valuable. So Lizzie rises from the vital to the mental. But Sri Aurobindo says, being in the mental is better than being in the vital, for sure. Being calm, say, why is, when Appa says, be cheerful, whatever happens, Mother says, smile at life. Whatever happens, smile at life. You mean even when somebody insults me? Smile at life. Even when somebody abuses me? Smile. Why? Because when you're smiling at life, you're not reacting against life. When you're smiling at life, you'll be receptive to get the knowledge that life is trying to offer you, that your soul is trying to offer you, that Mother's trying to offer you, so that you come out of it and those things never come back again. But Sri Aurobindo says that just because you rise from the vital to the mental, oh yes, yes, I see I'm filled with impurities, it was not his fault, I shouldn't be blaming him, I blame myself. That's not self-knowledge. That's better than the ignorance of the vital. But that's really not knowledge of the self. Why? Because the thing by which I am looking at myself, the power which Lizzie is using to detach herself from the vital and analyze it, is what? What power is she using? Mind. The whole book he's been telling us in every chapter, mind is an instrument of ignorance. Mind is more conscious than the vital. So rising from the vital reaction, or the reaction, whether it's a positive reaction or a negative reaction, Lizzie has to withdraw from her positive charm of Wickham, just as she has to withdraw from her anger at Darcy. She has to do both. She rises from the vital to the mental. She rises from being a vital person to a mental person. But what do you get when you become a mental person? You're still in the ignorance. You're still dividing everything. You're still judging everything from the superficial point of view. In fact, we're still in the ego. We're still judging the things from my point of view. This is good for me, this is bad. This is success, this is failure. Now I'm very calm. Now I'm, but I'm still judging things from the ego's point of view. So that's why Mother says, the first rule of psychic education. What's the first rule of psychic education? I mention it in every meeting we have, I think. Don't rely on the mind's externalized way of seeing things. It's one thing, don't react. Don't be emotional. Don't be disturbed. Be cheerful. But he said, don't rely on the mind's externalized way of seeing things. It's not the true knowledge. It's not the truth. It's not, it doesn't tell you really the truth. That's not real knowledge. So, what should Darcy do when she abuses him? Rather, take this into it. What should she do when she gets the news of Lydia's elopement? And what does she feel when Darcy walks out the door? She says, I know I'll never see him again. Certainly he will never come back again, no? When Darcy proposed to her, yes, Ashok.
Just now you said the non-reaction is very powerful and helpful. I agree it may work at the level of individual sadhaks and devotees of Mother, but I am very doubtful if such a policy will work at a national level. So every time Pakistan intrudes into Indian territory in Jammu and Kashmir,
sorry, we hear the loudness, Ashok, but I'm not able to hear the words clearly. Can you repeat the last sentence again? Slowly, a little more slowly.
What I was saying is that policy of non-reaction may be useful at the individual sadhak level. But I am doubtful whether such a thing is applicable at the national level. Say, every time the Pakistani army intrudes into Indian territory, Jammu and Kashmir, the Indian army quickly retaliates. What you seem to be saying is, even if the Pakistani army intrudes into Indian territory, the Indian army can keep quiet and let this thing go on. How is this anyway permissible?
Your example is easy to answer because when we say non-reaction, we're talking about psychological reaction, not action. I don't say you shouldn't act. Even in the Gita, it says you cannot stop acting. Whether you retaliate or don't retaliate, it's both an action. You stop reacting. Reacting means, what do? They have attacked us, attacked the village. We get angry, we get proud, we start shouting, we feel very self-righteous. All the problem is on their side. We refuse to look at the problem dispassionately. Non-reaction doesn't mean you don't act and do what's necessary. If you're a mother's devotee, that's something different. If you can not act, that's non-initiative. That's even more powerful. But that we can discuss. But non-reaction means don't be caught in the vital sensation of the experience. Get the knowledge you should get out of it. When I react, I don't get the knowledge. Why are they doing this? Do you understand why they keep bombarding us? Do you understand what's really the solution to the Kashmir problem? Appa has given the clue. I don't think anybody in India understands the truth of it. The truth, the real problem behind Kashmir and the partition between Pakistan and India is the caste system and the persistence of the caste system and the untouchability in India, which Gandhi, great credit to him, he understood that was the root problem that India had. We still don't know that. We're still fighting them as the enemy. Our enemy is we're divided among ourselves. Our enemy is all the old prejudices are still there. We're oppressing 25% of the population, and then we're complaining because Pakistan's sending a few missiles across the border. So non-reaction means instead of being self-righteous and proud or defensive or they're wrong and everything, we try to get the knowledge from the experience. That we can't get as long as we're reacting. Now you raise the question, is there something more powerful than action? Should we act or not? And Appa says, and they say, non-initiative is a higher discipline than non-reaction. Non-initiative means it shouldn't be an initiative of our ego. When Collins runs out of the house and goes and proposes to Charlotte, it's not only a reaction, but he takes an initiative to go and marry the next girl he sees. When Lizzie refuses Darcy, he not only decides not to react, he doesn't take initiative. And what happens? She comes to Pemberley. She comes back. He changes. He said, let me change myself. Let me make the progress I should make. And when he makes that progress, she comes. It's life's initiative. It's life bringing back the positive circumstance where he can complete what he failed earlier. So non-initiative means not even non-action. It means don't act. Don't let the ego move you to action. When life sanctions it, or something deeper spiritual sanctions it, that's different. And Darcy's is an example. Her coming to Pemberley was the clear sanction that he has made a progress and that he's no longer the last man on earth for her. I hope it's clear.
much clearer to me now.
Very good question. So, in summary, all of this boils down to how can we derive the maximum value from our experience? We all think in some way or other we are lacking something we need. But actually, everything we need is being offered to us at every minute. We just don't recognize it. We think the answer is there. I need this job or this alliance or this money or something else. All that we need is knowledge. Because the purpose of our being here is, I don't mean a book knowledge or a, you know, an academic knowledge or to have more information than other people. The knowledge that is power. The knowledge Sri Aurobindo and Mother and Appa are talking about is not a mental knowledge, it's knowledge that is power. Power for what? Power for accomplishment. Power for what accomplishment? Power to fulfill the deepest aspirations of your soul, the spiritual intention of your birth. And that knowledge you don't need to go to school for or read books for. It's being offered to us at every minute. And all we need to do is we need the dictionary or the translation device. Now on the internet, you can translate one language into another instantly. I'm getting letters in Croatian and Italian and Spanish and things like that. One instant later, it gives you the translation. They have given us the universal translator for translating any experience into knowledge. We've talked about some of those converters. Non-reaction is a converter. Taking the other person's point of view is a converter. It converts ignorance into knowledge. Non-initiative is a converter. Another one is to know that everything out that happens outside is a reflection of inside, which we talk about all the time. That what is Lizzie supposed to learn from her experience when she's so embarrassed by her mother's vulgar... Her mother's so embarrassed and she comes to Netherfield and speaks and quarrels with Darcy. She comes to the Netherfield ball and behaves so boorishly. When Bingley comes back to Longbourn after Lydia's marriage, she almost abuses Darcy. Well, you are also welcome. Any friend of Bingley, Lizzie wants to hide her head. She wants to run away. She's so embarrassed. What is she supposed to learn? She's supposed to understand that what her mother expresses outwardly, she has something of that in her vital. And she should consecrate that. She should outgrow it. And she does to a significant extent. I'm all admiration for Lizzie, but it's still there at the end of the story. Darcy has made a great progress. We all admit it, I'm sure. When he goes and saves Lydia and Wickham, he's made a great progress. But then his aunt comes to him in London and tells him that I went and met that Elizabeth Bennet and she refuses to do what I said and I told her all of these things. How will he feel? She's going and abusing the girl I want to marry. What an impossible thing. She's doing so rudely, so boorishly. I feel like strangling my aunt. Why is she doing that? Oh, still, everything she says, there's something of that in me. I'm still thinking like that, that we have an important class, important position, we have wealth, and she should be lucky. Yes, yes, I would never say that. But something of my aunt is still there in me. That's why... It comes. Even after I have saved Lydia and proved how much I love Elizabeth, that consciousness is still in me. I have not fully outgrown it. Well, I'm going to detach from this. I don't care what Lady Catherine says. I'm not even going to invite her. It's Lizzie that convinces her to invite Lady Catherine to the wedding and to befriend her. Not Darcy, because he understands that he has to outgrow that. So recognize what comes outside is a reflection inside. It's not an accusation. It's knowledge. It's power. Recognize. He talks in this about causality. Recognize that that anything that happens simultaneously in time or space is related. If I'm thinking of somebody and I get this message, there's a relationship between them. If I'm thinking of something and somebody comes in the door, there's a relationship. If I'm thinking of something and a feeling comes in me, there's a relationship between what I'm doing and what I'm feeling. It's not just other people. Whatever is simultaneous in space and time is related, even if there appears to be no causal link between it. It gives us a knowledge that we don't have. Look at events impartially, impersonally, without... Yes, Ashok?
You are watched two incompatible positions at the same time.
Quite possible.
For all that I know, outer achievement calls for plenty of outer initiatives. I think the U.S. accomplished so much mainly by taking so many initiatives.
Yes.
The one side, we face a situation where outer accomplishment calls for plenty of outer initiatives, but at the same time, we understand that inner accomplishment calls for cessation of all types of initiatives. On the one side, you are asked to constantly take initiatives. On the other side, in the spiritually speaking, you are asked to stop taking all initiatives. So, what is this phenomenon?
Very good question. These things need constant clarification, because the words can be used in different ways. What I said, if you remember back, is egoistic initiative. So the question comes down to, and it's a good topic for a two-hour discussion, not a two-minute reply, but the question, the idea is, don't take egoistic initiative. That's different than action. I tried to make a distinction between action and egoistic initiative. When the proprietor of a company demands the subordination of his staff because his prestige, don't you know I'm the boss here? You must do what I say. When he does it because he wants to maintain his prestige, it's an egoistic initiative. When he understands, like you know the example of one of our clients who insisted that all of the phones in each of his offices must be of a particular color, and got very angry when the executive was not spending all of his time rearranging the color of the phones, rather than doing his real job. That was out of pride. That was, I told you to do it, you have not done it. Whereas the responsibility of the owner or the manager or the supervisor or the at any level is to do what should be done. Not what I like to do, not what's pleasing to me, not what's convenient, what the work demands, the subordination of my personal preferences and my prestige and my ego to the work is the move from the ego to non-ego. And that's, so when the American or whoever it is, you mention American, works very hard because he believes that the work demands that, and he does what the work demands rather than what's convenient, doesn't mean he wouldn't be like to be home sleeping or watching the sports or being with his family like everybody else. But he believes that he should subordinate his preferences to the requirements of the work in that measure, we're saying his effort or his action is non-egoistic. He gives greater, when Mr. Bennett, best example for us is when Mr. Bennett believes that Mr. Gardner has spent £6,000 or £7,000 or £8,000 on Lydia's wedding, it's certainly not convenient for Mr. Bennett to say, I must repay him. When Mr. Bennett says, I must repay him, that's not what we mean by an initiative. There's nothing in Mr. Bennett's ego that wants to repay him. There's everything in his sense of honor that says, I must repay him. Because if Mr. Bennett's an insincere person, he'll say, see, Appa said don't take initiative, so repaying him is an initiative, so I won't repay him. I'll wait and see what happens. That's not non-initiative. That's the not repaying is also an initiative. It's an ego. In this case, not repaying is an egoistic initiative because it's convenient for me. Because that means I don't have to discipline myself and my wife, and I don't have to reduce the expenditure. That's very nice. I like this. Now I got a spiritual principle to justify my laziness. The principle is I shouldn't do something because my ego prefers it. I should do what's right. That's what Appa means by non-initiative. Really an important point. So I think we have pretty much covered it, and I was just summarizing some of the ways we extract that knowledge. And detachment, don't justify ourselves, be sincere. And the formula, eternal formula that Appa is giving is, have goodwill for other people and be happy and eager for their success and their fulfillment, because that tells us we're moving out of the ego and responding to people from a deeper truth. What is that truth? The truth is everybody's good fortune is our good fortune. Everybody's fulfillment is our fulfillment. Everybody's happiness is joy coming into our life. Thank you.
It is a very good experience for us. We listened to the talk of Mr. Gary, sir. He talked about the experiences day by day, minute by minute, what we are gaining. Through that, what we are getting, what we have to see, only through experiences we will gain the knowledge. Maybe it is an egoistic attitude or ego, but because Appa says mother comes to us only through values. If we are following that values, that every experience will be ours, it is great, the experience will give our psychological growth. That soul, for the soul it is necessary. We are seeing partially, and he said that it is, we have to be impartial, impersonal. If we are looking the things and the people and the what the things are happening, if we are seeing on the other man's point of view, if we are following that values, it will give great progress in our life, and that is prosperity. For that accomplishment, this is needed. So nobody is pressurizing us to do, but we have to take how Lizzie and how Darcy took that initiative, took that initiative without mother. We are telling that we are mother devotees, then we have to take that that values day by day, minute by minute, and we have to get that experience in our life. But everybody has that self-experiences. That self-experiences, we are only getting that much of knowledge. And through that Pride and Prejudice experiences and so many things, Gary sir explained to us very clearly, and now our part is we have to think and get the experience more and more evident in our life to get that progress and the knowledge in our life. That is what we need. And I am using this occasion to specially thanking Mr. Gary.